Thank you, Ed, for that kind introduction, and thank you to Bloomberg for the opportunity to speak at this event today. I'd like to address some of the issues about how monetary policy decisions taken elsewhere influence financial conditions here in Australia. So Australia is a small open economy. It's influenced by developments in the rest of the world. Financial conditions here can be affected by changes in monetary policy settings elsewhere, most particularly in the US, given its importance for global capital markets. However, Australia retains a substantial degree of monetary policy autonomy by virtue of its floating exchange rates. In other words, a change in policy rates elsewhere need not mechanically feed through to Australian interest rates. And even though Australian banks raise significant amounts of funding in offshore markets, they are able to insulate themselves and, by extension, their Australian borrowers from changes in interest rates in other jurisdictions. But just before I delve into some of those details, some context I think is in order. First, Australian banks have long borrowed in wholesale markets, including those offshore. However, they do so much less than used to be the case, as you can see here in the green line. For a number of reasons, domestically sourced deposits have become an increasingly large share of overall funding for banks. And second, to the extent that Australian banks have continued to tap into offshore wholesale markets, it's worth reflecting on some of the characteristics of that borrowing. For instance, some banking sectors around the world, some of those borrow in US dollars in order to fund their portfolio of US dollar assets. And that can leave them vulnerable to intermittent spikes in US interest rates. However, this is generally not the case for Australian banks. Rather, a good deal of their borrowing offshore, a good deal of the borrowing by Australian banks in US dollars particularly, reflects the choice of the banks to diversify their funding base in what are deep, liquid capital markets. By implication, if the costs in the offshore US dollar funding market increase noticeably relatively to the home market, then Australian banks can pursue other options. They might opt to issue a little less in the US market for a time, switching perhaps to other markets, or they may even just issue less offshore. They're not forced to acquire US dollars at any price, as some other banks may be. Another important feature of this offshore funding, and I'm going to come back to the detail of that in just a moment, is that the banks are not exposed to exchange rate risks and as they hedge their borrowings denominated in foreign currencies. So as Ed suggested, and as you're well aware, the US Federal Reserve has been raising its policy rate in recent years, and interest rates in the US are now higher than in Australia. These developments reflect differences in spare capacity and inflation. So unemployment in the US is at very low levels, inflation is at the Fed's target, and inflationary pressures there appear to be building. And since August 2016, which is the last time the Reserve Bank changed its cash rate target, the Federal Reserve has raised policy its policy rate seven times by a total of 175 basis points. And yet, while Australian banks raise around 15% of their funding in US dollars, as you can see here, at least for housing, interest rates paid by Australian borrowers since that time have really been little changed. So that leads us to wonder, how is it that interest rates for Australian borrowers have been so stable, despite the fact that Australian banks have borrowed some $500 billion in US capital markets in US dollars and paying US dollar interest rates? And the answer, as I'll go through it carefully, lies in the hedging practice of the Australian financial sector. As I'll demonstrate, Australian banks use hedging markets to convert their US interest rate obligations into Australian ones. The Australian banks fund their Australian dollar assets via a number of different sources. Some of their funds are obtained in US dollars from US wholesale markets. And in order to extend these US dollar funds to Australian residents, they convert the US dollars they've borrowed into Australian dollars soon after the securities are issued in the US. On the surface, it would appear such transactions could give rise to substantial foreign exchange and interest rate risks for Australian banks, given that the banks must first repay the principal amount of the security at the maturity in US dollars. So an appreciation of the US dollar increases the cost of repaying the loan in Australian dollar terms. And second, the banks must meet their periodic coupon or interest payments in US dollars, which are tied to US interest rates. So a rise in US interest rates would increase interest costs for Australian banks that extend loans to Australian borrowers. At least that's how it would seem. But it's standard practice for banks, Australian banks, to eliminate or at least substantially reduce both of these risks. And they can and do this by using a derivative instrument known as a cross-currency basis swap. Such instruments are a relatively cost-effective way of transferring risks to parties that have the appetite and the capacity to bear them. Simply put, cross-currency basis swaps allow parties to swap interest rate streams in one currency for another, and they consist of three components. So, excuse me, let's step through those carefully. Hopefully this diagram will help. So, let's step through it in three stages. The first one is that the Australian banks raise US dollars in US wholesale markets. Then the Australian bank and its swap counterparty exchange principal amounts at current spot exchange rates. So in other words, the Australian bank swaps the US dollars it's just borrowed and it receives Australian dollars in return. And with those Australian dollars, it can extend Australian dollar loans to Australian borrowers. Then over the life of the swap, the Australian bank and its swap counterparty exchange a stream of interest payments in one currency for a stream of interest payments in another. In this case, the Australian bank pays an Australian dollar interest rate to the swap counterparty and it receives a US dollar interest rate in return. The Australian bank can then use the interest payments from Australian borrowers to meet the interest payments to the swap counterparty, and it can pass the interest received from the swap counterparty onto its bondholders. And then at the maturity of the swap, the Australian bank and its swap counterparty re-exchange the principal amounts, and the Australian bank can then repay its bondholders. In effect, the Australian bank has converted its US dollar, US interest rate obligations into Australian dollar, Australian interest rate obligations. Now, for those who might be like me at first blush, you struggle with these diagrams, I think maybe just a brief analogy might help. It's one that's related to housing, and I think it can help to further the intuition here. So imagine there's a Bloomberg employee who owns an apartment in New York, lucky them, but they've accepted a temporary job in Sydney. If she fully expects to return to New York and wishes to keep her property, and she does not wish to purchase a property in Sydney, well, the obvious solution there is for her to receive rent on her New York property and use it to pay her US dollar mortgage. So she, in a sense, is handing the asset of her apartment out for a while for them to cover her US dollar interest rate costs. And meanwhile, she rents an apartment in Sydney using her Australian dollar income. In other words, the worker who's relocating here can temporarily swap one asset for another. And as a result, she can reduce the risks associated with servicing a US mortgage with an Australian dollar income. So it's essentially what the Australian banks are doing. As I mentioned earlier, it's common practice for Australian banks to hedge their foreign currency borrowings with derivatives to insulate themselves and their Australian borrowers from fluctuations in foreign exchange rates and interest rates. The most recent survey of hedging practices showed that around 85% of banks' foreign currency liabilities were hedged. Also, the maturities, as you can see here, of the derivatives used were well matched to the maturities of the underlying debt securities. So that meant that the banks were not exposed to foreign currency or foreign interest rate risk for the life of their underlying exposures. And by matching maturities, the banks also avoided the risk that they might not be able to obtain replacement derivatives at some point in the future. A Apologies for the glariness of these colours, but they worked well on my screen. For the very small share of liabilities that are not hedged with derivatives, there's almost always an offsetting high-quality liquid asset denominated in the same foreign currency of a similar maturity, so such as a US Treasury security or a deposit at the US Federal Reserve. And so taken together, these derivative hedges and these natural hedges, they mean that Australian banks have only a very small net foreign currency and foreign interest rate exposure overall, as shown in the graph here by the dot, which is the net after hedging. So that leads us to the question of who is bearing all of this risk. Well, despite Australia's external net debt position, in net terms, Australian residents have passed on key risks associated with their foreign currency liabilities to foreign residents. Australian residents have found enough non-residents willing to lend them Australian dollars and to receive an Australian interest rate to extinguish their foreign currency liabilities. And as a result, Australians are net owners of foreign currency assets, not borrowers. Collectively, Australians have used hedging markets and natural hedges to eliminate their exchange rate exposures associated with raising funds in offshore markets. Now, Australians' ability to find non-residents willing to assume Australian dollar and Australian interest rate risks is a reflection of the willingness of non-residents to invest in Australian dollar assets. And this in turn reflects Australia's status as a country that has long had strong and credible institutions, a high credit rating, and a mature and liquid capital markets. The willingness of these non-resident counterparties to assume these risks via direct exposure to Australia's banking system reflects the fact that Australia's banks are well capitalised and maintain high credit ratings. In short, Australians have found a source of finance unavailable domestically, and it's provided at reasonable price, and non-residents have found an asset that suits their portfolio needs. But since there are no free lunches in financial markets, there's a question of the cost for the Australian banks to cover these arrangements. And one part of this cost is known as the basis. So some swap counterparties have an inherent reason to take the other side to these deals with the Australian banks. In other words, such exposures actually help them to manage their inherent risks. So non-residents, for example, that issue Australian dollar debt in what's called the kangaroo bond market, they're a case in point. So these issuers raise Australian dollars here, but they're to take home to fund foreign currency assets they hold outside of Australia. And so that makes them natural counterparts to the Australian banks wanting to hedge their foreign exchange exposures. Similarly, Australian residents might be investing in assets offshore, and they may want to hedge some of those associated exchange rate exposures, and they too would be natural counterparts for the Australian banks. But it turns out that these natural counterparties do not have sufficient hedging needs to meet all of the Australian dollar demands of the Australian banks. So in order to induce a sufficient supply of Australian dollars into the foreign exchange market, Australian banks pay an additional premium to their swap counterparts on top of the Australian dollar interest rate. And this premium or hedging cost is known as the basis. Simply put, the basis is the price that induces sufficient supply to clear the foreign exchange swap market. You can see here, since the start of the decade, the basis has oscillated around 20 basis points per annum. Typically, though, but not always, the longer a bank wishes to borrow Australian dollars, the higher the premium it must pay over the Australian dollar interest rate. Now, you may be wondering, why is it that Australian banks are willing to pay this premium? Why don't they instead just borrow Australian dollars in Australian capital markets to meet all of their financing needs? Well, in addition to this prudent desire to diversify their funding base, as I mentioned earlier, the short answer is that it may not be cost-effective to raise all of their funding at home. What tends to happen is that banks, to the extent possible, they seek to equalise the marginal cost of each unit of funding from all of the different sources. And if they were to obtain all of their funding at home, well, that would be likely to increase the cost of those funds relative to the funds that they might get from offshore. So the all-in cost of the marginal Aussie dollar from domestic sources will tend to be about the same as the marginal dollar obtained from offshore. Now, any astute students of finance will also wonder why the basis is not just arbitraged away. And the answer is that structural changes in financial markets have widened the scope for market prices to deviate from values that might prevail in a world, a perfect world with no financial frictions. So this is consistent with the concept that there are perhaps some limits to arbitrage. Arbitrage typically requires someone to enlarge their balance sheet and incur credit, mark-to-market, and or liquidity risk. And as Claudio Borio of the BIS has noted, balance sheet space is rented. It's not free. And the cost of that rent's gone up. So what about financial conditions more generally? Well, none of this is to suggest that monetary policy settings in the US have no impact on financial conditions here in Australia. But my point is just the link is neither direct nor is it mechanical. The primary channel, of course, is through which foreign interest rates influence Australian conditions is through the exchange rate. An increase in policy rates elsewhere will, all else, tend to put downward pressure on the Australian dollar because capital is likely to be attracted to the higher interest rates of higher rates of return available abroad. And a depreciation of the Australian dollar will in turn tend to enhance the competitiveness of our exporters, including those services priced in Australian dollars like tourism and education. And through various channels, exchange rate depreciation can also loosen financial conditions in Australia, which is not always the case in other countries, as we've been noticing of late, particularly those for which inflation expectations are not well anchored and where there are substantial foreign currency borrowings that are unhedged. Foreign monetary policy settings, particularly those in the US, can also affect global risk premia. So we're now approaching a period when US monetary policy is moving to a neutral stance, but this follows a very long period of very easy monetary conditions, which may have encouraged investors to search for yield, to maintain a nominal portfolio return in an environment of low interest rates. And the expectation of low and stable policy rates and inflation outcomes in turn help to compress risk premia across a range of asset classes. And so in the period ahead, it seems plausible that term and credit risk premia will tend to rise, which will increase the cost for all borrowers, Australian banks included. So let me just draw a few brief concluding points. Global developments undoubtedly influence Australian financial conditions. In particular, developments abroad can influence the value of the Aussie dollar and affect global risk premia. But changes in monetary policy settings elsewhere need not and do not mechanically feed through to the funding costs of Australian banks, and hence their borrowers are insulated from some such changes. Let me finish up there, and I'm in your hands, Michael. Thank you.
Which one? Do you want to take
that? Either one, yeah.
Thank you, Glass. Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm Michael Heath. For those who don't know me, I do economics for Australia for Bloomberg. Chris, I just wanted to open up with the Aussie dollar. Australian bond yields are at multi-decade lows relative to their US counterparts, and yet the Aussie dollar is still trading close to its long-term average against the greenback. What's behind that, and is that a concern for you?
Well, I would focus less on the Aussie versus US specifically. I think what we can and try to do is use models to think about the broader exchange rate through the trade-weighted index. We've recently just updated our model, actually. But like all of our other models, it has quite a wide range of uncertainty. Roughly speaking, the current value of the Aussie dollar in TWI terms is within that range. So what's been happening over the past couple of years is, yes, you're right, we've had the yield differential declining into negative territory against the US. But the effect of that's been offset by a modest trend increase in commodity prices, which have been a bit higher than people expected.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Just coming back to the implications from international monetary policy on financial conditions in Australia. There's been a flood of foreign flows into Australia's repo market, and that's been a key driver for higher interbank borrowing rates. Are you concerned that this could hamper the RBA's capacity to manage monetary policy? As an example, perhaps banks might not pass on a cut if, in the event that you were to cut interest rates.
Well, in answering this, I won't be speculating about the possibility of a cut, but so I think what you're referring to is that the costs of obtaining Aussie dollars in short-term money markets went up earlier this year, and part of that was because of an increased demand by non-residents for Aussie dollars for various reasons, and it did have some effect on repo markets. But what's happened since then is rates have eased back across various money markets a little bit, and what we've faced, therefore, is a modest increase in funding costs for banks over, say, 2017 averages, but it's pretty modest. Mm. And yes, they've passed on some of that to their borrowers, business and household borrowers. At least in the housing space, that followed that increase was modest, and it followed a year when not many people noticed, but I was happy to tell people recently the average cost of Australian mortgages had come down modestly, at least up to August of last year. Mm-hmm. So it's modest in the scheme of things.
Sure. I'm just going to ask one more question, and then I'll throw it to the audience for some questions as well. Last week, the yields on cash rate futures came in, moved to below the actual cash rate all the way through to the end of next year. Is that a reasonable reaction to recent events?
Well, I believe that was a reaction to the weaker than expected national accounts. Mm-hmm. I'd put it in context, though. It was a fairly small move, and markets had not priced in much of a chance for a rate increase for some time. What we've been saying for a while now is that we're making some progress on bringing down the unemployment rate, lifting the inflation rate, but it's gradual. So the next move's likely to be up, but not anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions from the audience. Martin Wetton, I see over there.
Thank you. The cross-currency basis, also known as Bill's LIBOR, the LIBOR side is disappearing in 2 years, or a bit over 2 years. And on the Aussie side, we seem to have BBSW endorsed, I guess, from the RBA, or at least from the markets, as a unsecured reference rate that's going to stay. Are there any thoughts that for banks who will still borrow offshore and therefore will have a BBSW on one leg and a repo rate on the other, would the RBA consider something, setting up a reference rate based on repo? But obviously, as Michael pointed out, the last year has been very volatile in that particular benchmark. Is there a way that you could perhaps set up a term curve yourselves to try to take the volatility out of that spread and, in effect, give a Bill's LIBOR market a second chance?
Well, I think that's a question faced by many market participants globally, not just in Australia, where these different financial instruments are trading across and using different reference rates, some of which are more durable than others, and I would rate the BBSW rate as a durable one. But it's not necessarily for the central banks or the regulators to sort of go and set up all of these benchmark rates. We didn't do that in the case of BBSW. We obviously expressed views and tried to assist in that process, and that's what the regulators are doing globally, really just trying to raise the profile of these issues in the market's mind. And at the moment, through various forms and bodies, including ISDA, they're doing a lot of work trying to think about what are the alternatives here, what are the fallbacks in place, and trying to get an arrangement in place that will be suitable. So, but it's not for us to specifically sort of generate a new benchmark, such as you suggest.
Further questions? Chris, hi, Andrew Ticehurst from Nomura. Just on a question on big picture policy issues. You mentioned the Fed, of course, have raised rates a number of times in the context, of course, their economy is doing well, the unemployment rate's down to 3.7, but there's still not a lot of inflation in the US. My colleagues in Japan are not seeing much inflation either, with an unemployment rate at 2.4. And my buddies in Asia are worried about the risk of deflation from digital disruption. So my question is, of course, what's a good central bank to do here if we get the unemployment rate down to 4.5 and inflation still notably below the middle of the band? Or what if we get to 4.0, which in one sense, of course, would be a nice problem to have, but inflation's still below the middle of the band? What do we do?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't be quite so pessimistic about the sort of outlook for a pickup in inflation, in part because one of the important elements of it is wages. And across those regions you talked about, even in Europe, also in Japan and in the US, you're seeing a pretty gradual but steady pickup in wage growth. We have also seen that starting to happen in Australia, and we're forecasting, as the unemployment rate continues to fall, that that process will continue on. And that's part of the reason why we forecast a further gradual lift in inflation. Inflation in Australia has already lifted a bit. It's got further to go. So I wouldn't be quite so pessimistic about that. I think what we have said and everyone's acknowledged is it does seem, at least offshore, you've needed tighter labour markets than you might have thought in the past to generate that wage growth. But the wage growth is coming, and it's gradually increasing, I think.
Another question, Duffy.
I'm Phil Lasker from the ABC. People are saying, you know, obviously the forecast for the cash rate is that it's not going to move for a long, long time. Some people are saying the first move might not be until 2020. Is the essence of your message today and what you've explained is that households need not fear an out-of-cycle cash rate, an out-of-cycle interest rate increase from the banks during that time as well?
No, I don't think I could sort of be so prescriptive. I guess I look back at what happened earlier this year, and there was an increase in funding cost pressures for the banks. They did pass on some of that, and I just reflected on the fact that that was a fairly modest increase in the scheme of things. I think what we have been saying for a long time, though, is that in a world where household debt is fairly high, households do need to think very carefully and prudently about managing their financial affairs, and they need to be ready and willing to pay higher rates if and when that time comes. So, but I'm not going to sort of predict sort of what's exactly going to happen to banks' funding pressures and therefore what they might be doing on interest rates, but just say that what's happened of late has been fairly modest.
Other questions out there? No? Okay, come back to me.
I'm not going to...
Oh,
sorry.
Where are we?
Thanks. Ray Atchell, National Australia Bank. Just going back to what we were talking about earlier, so obviously there's been a little bit of a market response to the national accounts numbers that we had last week, and I guess the defining feature of that did move the dial on markets was the household consumption component, and the RBA has been very explicit in saying it's probably the biggest area of uncertainty in terms of your economic outlook. So with those numbers obviously, I guess, challenging the forecast that were presented in the November MPS and the market's own view, sounds to me as though that's probably going to be the biggest component when you come back after Christmas and rethink the forecasts going into the February forecasting period. That is going to be, those concerns, if anything, look as though they've been elevated in the last national accounts numbers. Is that a fair comment?
Well, consumption was certainly a point of weakness. I think the thing that many have said in recent days is the fact that it's also been sort of a hard one to pin down in terms of it's been quite volatile from one quarter to the next. Look, we'll provide our regular update in February for our forecasts. And the national accounts are an important source of data, but this is one quarter's worth of data that we're talking about, and there are other important sources that we'll draw upon. And as I said, it's a bit puzzling on the consumption, why it's showing this kind of sawtooth pattern in the growth rates. In principle it should be a fairly smooth series, but it's not been behaving that way of late. But yeah, it'll be one of a number of things that we'll be looking at. I wouldn't overemphasize it as the only one, though.
I might pop in with a quick question here. Guy DeBell, the RBA's number two, mentioned last week that your monetary policy armoury includes scope for further rate cuts or even QE. Was the timing of putting that out there just coincidental, or are there storm clouds on the horizon, the global economy, that are sort of encouraging you to look again at what options you have available?
Well, I don't think there are... I don't think there are storm clouds maybe in the way that you might think. We've said the global economy is growing okay, but there are risks, and there are always risks, including important risks associated with the trade disputes at the moment, the trade tensions, also just sort of how the Chinese economy is going, for example. But we've also said, look, the US economy is pretty strong, and there is possibility of an upside risk to inflation there because wage pressures are building. Look, I think Guy's comments should be seen in the context of his giving a speech about the GFC. So it would be untoward for him not to mention things like QE and the like. We've said that it's likely the next move is up. That doesn't mean that if it's needed, that the next move might not be down. But that's not in our forecast, which are for, I'd emphasise, a gradual fall in unemployment, a gradual rise in inflation. So that's why the next move is likely to be up.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that could potentially really help you guys out would be a fall in the Aussie dollar. And it's been trading in a range for the past couple of years, as the central bank regularly notes. What's it going to take to finally for it to finally break lower? And I'm not talking about the Chinese economy tipping over or something like that. But give you the boost to growth and inflation that the economy obviously could really do with?
Well, the good story there to tell if it was to break lower, and just again reflecting on that model that I discussed earlier, would be because the yield differential moves in the same direction it's been moving for a while because the US Fed finds itself in the happy position of having to raise interest rates further. And that would come about because they are facing some upward pressures on inflation. They've got very, very low unemployment. So that's sort of the good news story where that would be stimulatory.
Mm-hmm. And for us?
The bad news story would be if there was an adverse shock offshore that really adversely affected significantly commodity prices.
Mm-hmm. Just on the Fed, there's obviously a wide range of forecasts about what they're going to do. And we know the US really struggles to engineer a soft landing. Historically, that's been the case. I mean, is sitting still starting to look like their best or safest option now?
Well, I would just reflect on what it is they have been saying of late. And I think what they've been saying is that while they have this dot plot which provides their best guess of where they think they're going, they're getting to a point now because they're closer to what they think is a wide range of uncertainty of where the neutral rate is, but they're closer to that, that they just have to be more attentive to monitoring sort of economic developments. In other words, their ultimate decision to raise rates at any point in time will depend on the data that they have to hand at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any more questions out there? There we go.
In response to the question... Graham Hand from the Cufflinks newsletter. In the question asked about whether Guy DeBell's comments were related to the global economy, you said this is not a focus on storm clouds in the way that you might think. Mm. So if it's not in the way that he might think, which storm clouds are you thinking about? And... I haven't heard the word housing in the last 40 minutes.
Okay, but that doesn't sound like a question. I'll talk about the reference to the global economy. I think people can often talk about storm clouds when what they really mean is they're thinking about risks. I think the central forecast for the global economy is still a fairly positive one. Growth might be a little bit slower in some parts than was looking the case earlier this year, but depending on how some of these events transpire, things like particularly the trade tensions, which are a sort of an adverse negative risk that's sitting out there. It's already having some modest effect, I think, on global trade. It could have a bigger effect on, say, business investment through weighing on their willingness to invest, because they require more certainty to invest. So what I'm talking about is this, the way I was suggesting was just that the central forecast is a fairly positive one, but then there are risks either side of that. There's a lot of uncertainty. So what I don't like for myself to be saying is that the risks mean that this will happen and that global growth will be weak. It's more like it could, but there are other things that could happen that makes growth stronger than people anticipate at the moment.
Yep, sure.
I'm Justin Faber from Macquarie. You talked about households getting their finances together, and one aspect of that is borrowing. I don't want to labour the point too much, but as one of the key people in the bank that talks to the majors, I imagine, quite frequently, press reports about the CEO saying they want to lend. And clearly, they want to lend to good quality borrowers. But maybe frontline people are a bit nervous because of the Royal Commission being done for irresponsible lending. I mean, my sense is the bank is actually getting more nervous about this space. You've thought a lot of it's demand-driven today, but how nervous are you getting and what are you hearing from the banks?
Again, I would just convey the sense that it is a risk that the supply of credit tightens unnecessarily given broader economic conditions. And those conditions are fairly positive ones, right? Got business conditions that are pretty strong, got businesses planning to do more investment, unemployment's coming down, inflation's picking up, wage growth's picking up. So that's an environment where you wouldn't expect that would warrant a tightening in supply. It's coming from these other potential sources. We haven't seen too much of that on sort of at an aggregate level in the owner-occupier credit space. Credit there is still growing on a six-month ended annualised basis, just a bit over 6%. So that's not especially slow. I think one point of concern of late has been the tightening, potential tightening in credit supply to small businesses. And I think that is somewhat worrisome. The banks might be treating the small business more like a consumer in the way they think about extending a loan to them than as a business, and that may have led to a tightening in supply of credit to them. So I think that's a point of concern.
I might just jump in with one more too. You've mentioned trade a couple of times. Obviously, it's really uncertain whether there's been some sort of deal or what's going to happen there. The governor mentioned one of his big worries was markets telescoping back to now what they think might happen if things start to look like they're getting bad. How would that process work? I mean, where would things start to move in terms of markets if they really do worry that the US and China are set to really escalate the trade fight?
Well, if they became worried about the possibility of such an escalation, I think that would just lead them to be revising down their forecast for global growth. It's not immediately clear. It's not immediately clear that would have anything, any sort of exchange rate effect.
Mm-hmm.
You would imagine, longer term bond yields might come off a bit, which is sort of what they've done a little bit of late. I wouldn't overemphasize that. It's a modest pullback in bond yields on long term government bond yields globally of late. And that partly reflects, I think, some of those concerns. Those markets are always trying to process that information. What does it mean for global growth? What does it mean for global inflation?
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that it's going to weigh on either of those, things like yields would come down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any last questions out there? We're about to wrap up. No? Okay, well, I want to say thank you very much to Chris for making himself available, and thank you very much to everybody for taking time out of your schedule to come and listen. And wish you a happy holidays and happy new year, and we'll see you again in 2019. Thanks very much.
Cheers. Thanks very much.